Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, it's brown, black and yellow with a saw-like spike sticking out of its rear. We meet the author of a new book, Ireland Through Birds. And they may be slippery customers, but there's a lot more to eels than meets the eye.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
Oh, my all-time favourite, Simon and Garfunkel. You're very welcome to the programme and a very busy studio we have with us. On my left, we've got Dr. Richard Collins. In front of me, Aina Nilana, and to the right of Aina is fishery scientist Ken Whelan. Did you spill your coffee all over the table, Aina?
We'll have only to get a little bit of the table. I'm just about to clean it
we
up.
We will have to get you a cloth.
Make a show of me on there. Why not?
And sandwiched between Aina and Richard, we've got Conor O'Brien. In 2016, Conor had an ambitious idea which would ultimately take him all over Ireland. From the remote isles of Donegal to the rugged mountains of Kerry to the urban parks of Dublin. His plan was to seek out 12 of our rarest or most elusive birds. It was a journey which took him on trains, buses and boats to the four corners of Ireland across four seasons to enjoy close encounters with our lesser spotted birds, from seagoing pirates to songsters of the high mountains and ingenious forest dwellers. During his journey, Conor was enchanted by calling corncrakes, mesmerised by hunting harriers, and chased by angry skuas. The project took 2 years, and the resultant book is called Ireland Through Birds. And author Conor O'Brien joins us now. Conor, tell us all about the book, if I haven't already told you.
No, I think you've given a pretty good summation right there, but I think it was born really out of two desires. One, of course, was to see birds that I haven't seen before. I've been bird watching from an early age, but was frustrated that there were certain species that I hadn't seen, so I wanted to correct that. And the other main drive, just as important, was to see more of Ireland. I just think it's a fantastic country we have. Every corner of it has its own unique character and its own kind of story to tell. And I was frustrated by the fact that there were places in Ireland that I haven't seen. I think in an age where kind of air travel is easier and people kind of can travel around the world, we often take for granted, you know, that which we have at our own back door. And I was certainly guilty of that before I embarked on this book. I hadn't even been to the province of Ulster, and I was eager to correct that. And that was one of the journeys that I took.
You'd never been to Ulster?
I hadn't, no.
Can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 28.
I'm surprised at that. But there you go, you'd never been...
I'd never, no.
And what's it like?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, it was just fantastic, really, to travel around and to see different places. And one of the beauties of birdwatching, or one of the frustrations of it, really, is you don't always see what you're looking for, but you get to see somewhere new in the process, or you might even get to see something that you weren't expecting to see. So, yeah, that's... You never know what you can see.
All right, now what brought you up there? Because I'm making a program about eider ducks at the moment, and I'm told that if I want to see lots of eider ducks... Now, we have them in Skerries, can I just say? We have them on the north, west coast as well, but I'm told if you go up to Strangford Loch or to the Giant's Causeway, you'll see plenty of eider ducks.
Do you know what? Actually, that was one of the first indications that I knew I was somewhere different and I was going to see something special, because I was in Maharorty Pier waiting for the boat to Tory Island, and I saw three ducks just kind of a bit further out to sea. And I could just tell by the shape that it was something a bit unusual, and they were three female eiders. And I just thought, this is fantastic. I'd only ever seen eiders in Iceland before.
The sound they make.
Yeah. Were you in Northern Ireland?
I was in, so that was in Donegal, but I have been to Northern Ireland before, yes.
But you said you hadn't been to Ulster.
Yes, I hadn't been to the province of Ulster before until getting to Donegal. Yeah. Does that make sense?
No, because the six counties are in the province of Ulster as well. There's nine counties in Ulster.
Oh, no,
so
I know.
So if you've been to Northern Ireland, you had been in Ulster.
I hadn't been to Northern Ireland before I'd been to Donegal. So Donegal was my first venture into the province of Ulster. And then after that, I went to Northern Ireland, but unrelated to this book.
Ah, very good.
Yeah. So sorry for the confusion.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So but were you searching for eider at that stage?
No, I was looking for corncrakes.
So going to the province of Ulster brought you there in search of corncrakes.
That's correct.
Not the Shannon Callows.
No, I had heard that Tory Island was effectively ground zero for corncrakes, so I kind of decided to make my way up there, and I wasn't disappointed. What a beautiful place, fantastic place.
No, and indeed,
place to
if you listen to our Dawn Chorus, we've had corncrakes live from that part of the world
what
for
an
the
amazing
last 2 years.
Yeah, and it was quite a special thing for me to hear, because one of the things I mentioned in the book was that my father telling me that his father, so my grandfather as a very young man, used to hear corncrakes calling even in County Wicklow, and of course that's been generations since that's been the case. It's such, it's kind of a shame now that you have to travel much further to to try and hear that sound now in a summer. But it was amazing. And when I heard my first one, your heart skips a beat. It's a phenomenal feeling.
So is your book a travelogue?
I would say yes. I think that's a very good description of what it is. Yes. It's kind of traveling around Ireland and exploring the country that we have and looking for different birds.
So giving people something to look for along the way.
Yes, I think so. And I think that's part of the experience, really, because we have so much, we have obviously spectacular landscapes and each region has its own unique history, which feeds into its unique character. So I think that's just part of the
Well, that's kind of book you like, Aina, I would have thought.
Yes, indeed. I thought it was a great idea to do this, to pick different birds and go around looking for them. But I wouldn't have gone to the places you went to. I wouldn't have gone to Connemara to look for a cuckoo. And you didn't actually see one either.
No, so maybe I should have picked somewhere better. Who knows?
So did you decide? I mean,
take it easy, Aina.
Because the place to see cuckoos, and I am not a particularly good bird watcher, but we did the Dáil Corps a few years from the Burren. Mm. And you haven't got the Burren in this list at all. And if you were being a travelogue as well as the birds, because I suspect you wanted to go all around the country, so you couldn't just go to Wexford and Bullwall and that would get you all maybe birds, but you wanted to go around the country.
I did.
The Burren would have been a better inclusion than for the cuckoo. Just saying.
No, absolutely.
For the second edition.
But he has to leave something for the second
exactly,
book.
Exactly. Yeah. Not to leave other places.
No, but there
to
must be
to.
A reason why you did that.
I mean, do you know what? I had heard, obviously, the Burren and Connemara are two places that are very renowned for the cuckoo, probably the Burren more so, maybe. So, yeah, who knows? Maybe I should have gone to the Burren instead.
No, but that's deliberate because this is written. So you've chosen a place to go to in search of a bird. So you will find it or you won't find it. So you're being very honest in the book saying, well, I went there.
Yeah.
And do you describe why this is the particular habitat that's good for this bird? Why you went there in the first place? Did somebody tell you to go? And then you didn't see it on this day or these days? Blah, blah, blah.
One thing that I was kind of cognizant of was keeping tabs of, reported sightings and stuff like that. So in the build up to visiting Connemara, I'd heard of some sightings in the particular area that I had visited. Fortunately, no cuckoos the day that I arrived, but
they're all hiding behind the hedge.
I thought
it was great, though, the account you had on Inish Turk of the great schools.
Yeah.
You were attacked by those.
I was.
You're lucky to be alive.
Yes, quite possibly. Do you know what one thing I was thinking? If I was closer to a cliff and they were coming at me, it probably would have been a bit of a dodgy experience.
Did you go near their nest? It wasn't clear because
Before you answer that question, describe a great skua and where they live in the cliffs and all that.
Skua is effectively, in terms of its appearance, it's like a large, kind of bulky, robust brown gull in appearance. Now, it's not a gull, but that's kind of broadly what the appearance of it would look like. And as I recount in the book, unfortunately, I got a bit too close for comfort. I just kind of came over this sort of hill, sort of ridge, and there they were. And I thought, oh no, they're definitely going to come at me. And sure enough, that's what happened. So I had to beat a very hasty retreat. But I think it's best with a bird like that, or with any bird really, to give them a respectful distance and try not to disrupt them in any way. So that's the one thing that I endeavour to do.
Richard.
Well, I think to say this is a travelogue is far too limited.
No, I was only asking.
It's a book, it's a very rich tapestry, this thing, it's got all kinds of angles in it. It's very hard to write a book about 10 or 12 birds and make it interesting in a general sort of way. But there is no understanding a species without understanding the context in which it is, the world in which it lives and the factors that come to bear on it. So the result of this book is that he in wonderfully vivid descriptions, he evokes the world, the history of the places he's in, the mines in Glendalough and St. Kevin, and it brings the whole thing to life. And the same with all the other places, Loch Crumshanon and the Cumberness and the O'Toole's and O'Byrne's ravishing the countryside way back in medieval times, and the military road led was the result of that. He brings in all this wonderful thing. And then there are things reading it that you kind of realise you never noticed before. For instance, we were discussing last day how three reintroductions in Ireland, the red kite, the golden eagle and the white-tailed eagle, but there's a fourth And we don't think of it as a fourth. And that is, of course, the grey partridge, because grey partridges were brought in from Eastern Europe, two with Bura, to revive the dying. There were a few pairs left, yes, but this is an introduction and a successful introduction, but we don't tend to think of it in those terms. So I think it's a very, and there's other sort of things. We think of global warming as always going downwards, but yet the goosander, as you describe so well in the book, has come in and is, not thriving, but it's certainly increasing its and breeding here as it didn't do 100 years ago. So it is interesting from that point of view. I think it's a very attractive book. I usually don't like these kind of books because it's all facts and figures and one amazing discovery after the next amazing discovery, and you get tired of amazing discoveries after a while. But this thing is evocative. It's readable. You don't have to be a ferocious bird watcher to enjoy it, I think.
Have you got a question for Connor?
I have indeed got questions for you. Now, I'd love to know about the awful torment you must have gone through in selecting these 12 birds as opposed to all the other ones. I mean, it was a kind of an election among the birds. Which ones will I actually choose, you know? And you must have another dozen or so that were also-rans, or ones you regretted. You didn't put in. What's good? Is the next book going to be 12 mammals?
I don't know. I suppose in terms of picking the birds, yeah, I suppose the main factor was just looking for birds that I haven't seen before. So that was kind of the main factor. I wanted to kind of see as much of Ireland as I could. So looking for birds that kind of maybe have different presences in different parts of the country was a deciding factor as well, you know. Of course, there was another factor would be kind of like seasonality. So like one of the beautiful things, as you know, well know about bird watching in Ireland, is that the entire complexion of our avifauna changes throughout the year. You know, we have all of the waders and all of the ducks in the winter, and then birds like the cuckoo and the corncrake coming in summer, etc. So, that was kind of a deciding factor as well, you know, different places that I could travel to at different times of the year. In terms of birds that I didn't look for in the book that I would like to look for, I mean, there are so many Irish birds I'd love to see. One personally that I'd love to see that was, it'll be a difficult ask, would probably be the nightjar. I think, God knows, we probably don't have as many of those as we used to. And it seems to be a very, very hard, a very, very tall ask. But who knows?
More sounds rather than seeing.
Yes, you might make it 12 birds in Europe. The nightjar now, he's very scarce.
I
remember coming across him in East Anglia, but I never heard a nightjar in Ireland in all the years. So that would be a challenging one.
Absolutely.
I think that things like the water rail are very elusive. You hardly ever see, you hear them squealing, but you hardly ever see them. Those kind of things. I thought the jacksnipe was an excellent choice because he's one of these intriguing things. When I take people out and a snipe gets up and you say, now that might be a jacksnipe. He's a jacksnipe. This sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a very interesting one to pick.
Yeah, it's a very hard bird to see for sure. Absolutely.
Connor,
yeah.
You're making me feel really seriously old.
Oh.
I was amazed. No, this, it really does indicate what a mess we've made of the country. When you were talking about the corncrakes, I just suddenly remembered in the 60s just how many corncrakes we used to hear in an average day fishing on the Blackwater just outside of Navan.
Yeah.
You know, it is extraordinary that you would have to go and hunt for one of these animals.
Yeah.
And I can remember well going in on my first day surveying some bog areas around Ballygar in East Galway and the amount of grouse that were around me. I mean, it really did come home to me very quickly.
Yes.
That, we now have a young chap at 28 having to go and hunt for these birds that we were taking for granted. You know, so I think it is very, very good that you would do that sort of work and indicate to people that these are now becoming scarcer, and the fact that you had to hunt really emphasises the fact that they are becoming scarcer. And the same with the cuckoo.
What is it with the corncrake? I mean, there have been many projects to try and rehabilitate the numbers of corncrakes. Lots of money pumped in, changing in farming practices in terms of the cutting of the grasses and all that kind of stuff at times of year, and yet the corncrakes just hasn't managed to hold on.
It doesn't seem to have been the case. No, it just it really does seem like the kind of change of agricultural practices, like you said, the intensification of agriculture over the course of the last half century or so has just taken its toll, really, and they've largely been probably more, I would say, relegated, would you say, to the kind of more northern and western fringes of the country?
I think so. I think one of the big factors, and it's a big factor now we're going to be talking about for the next number of years, is this whole question of water, water retention, land drainage, and what we had in the past by way of callows and by way of intense, intense growth of grass.
Yeah.
So that the grasslands, we say, well, let's replace the grasslands. Mm. But the grasslands in those callows at that time were just so dense.
Yes.
And, you know, the habitat was just so rich that by compromising that, even though it might visually look the same, it's not the same.
No.
It's not the same habitat. And therefore, in a subtle way, we're not actually at all doing what we think we're doing. We do all the right, have all the right intentions, but putting back those boglands, putting back those callows, putting back those wetlands, it's fundamental to managing our water. But we're really not taking it seriously, in my view, because there are clear indications, both in terms of aquatic creatures and land creatures, that this is a major challenge. And I think we really have to focus on it. And it's a decadal challenge, not something you can do over 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that balance between the effects of the flooding and what's happening now in terms of land use, I think all of these are fantastic indicators. And the indicator that we're succeeding would be if we could actually start to establish really firm populations of these creatures that have been put under such pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a point to remember, and I'm sorry if this isn't really as relevant as that, it's not a specifically Irish problem. It does, like, the intensification of agriculture seems to be a Europe-wide phenomenon. Like, I know in places like France and Spain, a lot of steppe birds, like the both species of bustard, for example, have been just absolutely devastated by intensification of farming and, you know, earlier harvesting of fields, which of course makes it much harder for them to breed, devastates nests, etc. So, yeah, it is. It's not just a specifically Irish issue. But
can I ask you a question that I think, if I was listening to this, I'd say, why didn't that fella go out with someone who could show him the birds? Mm-hmm. Why did you go out by yourself and all this time and you didn't see this and you didn't see that? Mm-hmm. Whereas if someone like Eric Dempsey, someone like Richard Collins, who know the countryside so well, would have brought you to
I'm sure no guarantee you're going to see them even if fella like well, Richard Collins well, well, you or Eric Dempsey.
Well, there is actually quite a good guarantee. If
no, there isn't.
Well, we won't have
unless you, you nail the bird to the branch.
Well, I suspect you do.
I'm going to let Conor answer that.
Why would you not go? I mean, I'm only being the devil's advocate. Why would you not go with somebody who could show you where they were?
Well, for a few reasons. One, I find being in nature by yourself can be quite therapeutic. You know, I find, you know, bird watching by yourself, like it's a nice way to immerse yourself in nature. And I'm not alone for each of the journeys. Like sometimes I'm with friends. When I went down to Wexford, I was with my father. But I really wanted it to be kind of a case of myself kind of, as much as possible, in a place like Ireland where very tragically we don't have really massive wilderness anymore, to try and get out into the wilderness and try to find, you know, in a sort of man versus nature way, try to find the quarry, succeed or not succeed on my own merit, was kind of the way that I was hoping to, go about it. And if you were with a guide, you know, you'd be with someone who would know the area much better than you would. But I thought I'd try it by myself.
That's a different book, Conor, is the answer to that question.
It is, absolutely, yeah. I would agree, Conor, completely, because as listeners know, I'm privileged to work all over the world. And my thrill is to go and do it myself, is to go and set myself a species and go, for example, the Taimen in Mongolia, whatever. Mm. The satisfaction of sitting there on that river, you know, with that creature, that rare creature, that you've done it yourself. Mm. That's the edge,
yes.
You know, and the adventure. I think that's really what Richard was saying. If the adventure comes across then in the book, that's really the key to what we do. That's why we do it.
Yes.
So actually, the reason I say that too, Aina, it comes back to me. Years ago, I filmed red squirrels on the Isle of Wight for BBC for a program called Nature Detectives. Only I never filmed them, despite being there for 3 days and three nights. Because with all the experts in the world that they had, when we went there, the animals simply didn't turn up. And when we left the cameraman there and it turned up.
Yeah. So do you remember going to Iceland looking for the northern lights? Which hadn't
and
even
that's never happened.
And they didn't never,
I don't believe they exist anyway. Just a laser show.
I remember in Iceland wanting to see a gyre falcon, you see? And searching for gyre falcons and gyre falcons and giving up the ghost. And then it was in winter and there was snow, but there were these hot pools. And Barbara and I went into a hot pool.
In Iceland?
In Iceland, a hot pool. It's lovely. And what flies right over us, 10 metres above us, but a blooming giant falcon.
Yeah.
You know, it's this sort of crazy sort of juxtaposition of things. Why would the giant falcon fly over two people in a boat in the middle of winter?
Anyway, were you going to see the cuckoo, by the way, back to the original point, or to hear the cuckoo?
I was going to try and see the cuckoo.
Okay, did you hear it?
I didn't hear it in Connemara, no.
Have you ever heard it anywhere?
I've heard it in, as I recall in the book, in the Cumber Mountains of County Waterford. It's the only place I've heard a cuckoo. Actually, since I've completed this book, I'm happy to announce I've seen my first cuckoo, which is great. You know, I saw my first cuckoo, I saw it on Bull Island here.
Well,
in
heard my very first cuckoo with Ken Whelan.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
It was actually Ken. Can you still do it?
I don't know whether I can try.
I'll give it a lash.
Oh, yeah, you still
do it. Come on, try and do it. Go on.
Well, we'll have to.
Alex, you better explain what you're doing and why you did it.
Well, what happened was that where I was based, near Newport in County Mayo, there was one area in particular where there was quite a concentration of cuckoos, and they used to come and you could hear them in around this small lake.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I might see, could I actually call them and see, could I get them to buzz the boat?
Mm.
And they were surprisingly easy to call
if
you made the cuckoo sound, particularly if it was males that were obviously, I think, competing for mates.
Mm.
And they would come down and they would buzz the boat. I think Derek and I were out looking for mayflies, I think.
How many years ago was that?
It's a long time, a long time ago.
It was
now.
20 years ago, isn't it?
And there was cuckoos calling, and I said to Derek, well, maybe we can get one to come over to us, you know, and did my cuckoo sound. I don't think anything buzzed us that day.
No.
But certainly in Ballinlock now, I've had some great fun with them buzzing. But again, I mean, the numbers have really, they've really gone down. Mm-hmm. They really have.
Go on, do it.
So explain what you're doing, Ken.
Okay, what I'm doing now is I have a really important little gadget called my hands.
Yeah.
So I'm just cupping my hands together, and I'm just making a sound through my hands, you know.
Wait till we see if one calls back. Perfect, it did. Well done.
If my hands are slightly damp, I can get the sound much more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually cocked their head.
Yeah.
My brother one afternoon was just in hysterics of laughter. We had one male cuckoo, and he'd come down and he'd just hover over the boat like that, and he'd cock his head. And Brendan was saying, he's saying, what the hell is that? You know, and you could actually see the bird because he was so clear over us, you know.
Mm.
But I mean, again, no more than the curlews. We took those for granted when we were out fishing, you know. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
great memories. Anyway, Conor, well done.
Thank you.
It's
so
a terrific
much.
Book. It's called Ireland Through Birds by Conor O'Brien. It's published by Merriam Press and is priced at a reasonable €16.95. I say reasonable because you're going to have this for generations to come, and people will pass it on and pass it on and pass it on. There's nothing like the gift of a book, isn't that what they say?
Hopefully.
Did
so.
Did you have fun doing it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even if it wasn't to write a book, I'd go looking for birds regardless, you know. Maybe I'd pick a few better places next time. Who knows? Maybe the burn will I'll have more luck with cuckoos. But even just being able to see different parts of Ireland and just kind of try to immerse yourself in nature is just... Yeah.
Can I ask you, John was asking me on research yesterday, does anybody make money writing books anymore? Is there money in this game?
I don't know. Yes. No. It's,
sorry, Conor, I can tell you no. Yes. It's definitely not.
Well,
unless you write a bodice ripper, which I'm one of these days going to do. The chiclet people do well. But scientific books and these kind of ones.
You should go looking for chiclets, actually. That'd be quite a good book.
Who knows, maybe my next project. But no, I just wanted to try and... I've always wanted to write a book.
So it's for the love of it, really?
For the love of it, yes. And hopefully if someone enjoys it, then I'll
What's your background?
What's my background?
Are you a scientist yourself?
No, I'm not a scientist. No, I live a quite a boring life. I just work in communications primarily. I used to work for local newspapers, things like that. But yeah, not.
But your
not
passion is birds.
My
or
passion
ornithology.
Will be wildlife. Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Well, it's great to have you, and thank you very much indeed, Conor. Mooney@rte.ie is the address you can send any stories or queries to, which is exactly what Claire O'Connor from Tullamore in County Offaly did.
So it was around Monday evening at around 7-8 o'clock, and I was in the kitchen, and it was just after dinner, and my parents noticed this, like a wasp, but it wasn't a wasp, crawling along the kitchen window. And at first we thought it was like a wasp or a bee, but then we realised it was like a strange insect that we had never really seen before. So he had like red, yellow kind of legs, and he had wings as well, and he was just kind of crawling along. He was about the size of a 20-cent coin. And there was like a really low buzzing noise coming from him, but it was like nothing that we'd seen before. It definitely wasn't a wasp, so we were kind of like confused about it. I was like, what if it bites or something?
Aina, this is one for you, I think.
It's yet another picture of a sawfly. Yeah. And the sawfly is a fearsome looking creature indeed, because it actually has black and yellow stripes, and it seems to have what looks like the most enormous sting sticking out of its tail end. And obviously this is going to kill us all stone dead. Now what happens is that this insect uses this thing at the back. It's an ovipositor. It drills a hole in timber. It lays the egg into the timber and it goes away. And it takes about 2 years for this to hatch out. Meanwhile, the tree has been cut down, made into roof timbers, made into... And you move into your new house, you have your new baby, and you go up one day to the baby in the cot and there's the baby playing with this fearsome creature. Now, I'm not a bit afraid of it myself, just for my child, you understand. And the child isn't a bit afraid at all. Tried to have a great fun with it, but no, no, no. So anyway, that's what it was. Another one of these.
And now, we have a picture on our website.
We sometimes get them from Scandinavia and sometimes we get the Irish species, depending on whether the timber came from Scandinavia or not. They're different colour legs if they're from Scandinavia. But anyway, that's what it is. It won't do you any harm. The poor old thing is just flying around looking to drill its ovipositor and lay another egg someplace. Won't sting you, no interest in you. And it has this black and yellow colour as mimicry, this mimicry of fearsome creatures, so the birds won't eat it. So
Anna, I want to ask you, they call it a sawfly.
Yes.
Now,
also a horntail.
I know, yeah,
millions,
but the sawfly thing is interesting because it implies that the fellow comes along with these, or she, with her ovipositor, and she saws. She starts sawing into timber. Now, this seems to me a most implausible kind of thing for a little creature like that to do. Surely it sticks the ovipositor into an existing hole and not create a new
one. Well, it
one.
Does actually lay its eggs in soft woods rather than in hard woods, so it ain't going to be sawn into an oak tree. It's usually found in spruce trees that grow very fast and are quite sappy. So I suppose the rate of growth, particularly in Ireland, of these things, because they grow winter and summer, that they haven't got the same strength, in fact, as the ones that grow slower in Scandinavia, are probably easy enough to saw through on a molecular. The thing is quite fine, like a needle. Anyway, that's called a sawfly, and people seem to think it sawed a hole in it. But I'm sure they don't go for the hardest bit. They probably walk around the tree and see if there's a soft place first, and we can start.
The great spotted woodpecker uses dead trees. He likes the dead tree because it's going to crumble and he's going to
get. Also, he'll have a hollow inside that'll reverberate and give his echo because it's with the drumming that he actually communicates with other.
But what about the male? Creatures. Does he help out at all? Sawing or doing anything. He hasn't got the.
I know he hasn't got the weapon. He just does the business and goes and leaves it then to the.
Sounds very familiar.
Like, you know yourself. Come on.
But certainly, I remember now many years ago, my dad, Lord Reston, was very involved with wood and he used to get all sorts of interesting animals coming in with the wood, particularly in the past when there wasn't, in the 60s and so on, there wasn't the same controls. I remember sending a really exotic insect to Jim O'Connor in the Natural History Museum that my dad found. And it reminded me of a giant sawfly. It was yellow, it was black, massive grey proboscis. And when my dad cut the piece of wood, again, it was a soft wood, I think it was from South America, that he was just testing to see what whether or not it would be useful for the purpose he was looking at. So he cut it, and when he cut it, luckily he didn't damage the insect at all. He just opened the cavity. And you could actually see where the animal had bored in, and then the animal inside seemed actually to be hibernating. But we thought originally the animal was dead, but in fact the animal was alive. So I put it in a box and sent it off to Jim. Can't remember, we got back a lovely big Latin name, but I got no province about it.
And he kept it probably in a drawer in his cabinet.
Probably, but it was the most extraordinary thing. But it had certainly... It had made its way through the wood because you could actually see. It was just by chance the way the blade had gone. We got the whole thing in 3D. It was the most extraordinary creature. I'd say it was probably about maybe 5 or 6 centimetres long. So certainly, if you had your baby in the pram, you'd be very worried about that.
He's a marvellous bluffer, you know.
Who can?
Ken, I perish the thought that Ken would in any way be other than absolutely whatever. But anyway, I mean. He's adorned like a wasp.
So are hoverflies.
I mean, lots of things do this. This one is very, it's so successful that everyone is terrified when they see one, although it's totally harmless.
We don't actually have hornets in Ireland because, again, so far they're in warmer countries than here. But hornets only look like a big wasp. Even the hornets, which I've seen in France, do not have a huge big ovipositor or sting like the way we see these. Yeah. So it's a case of, reading too many books. This is just Well, as a poor, unfortunate sawfly horntail. Do you no harm, nothing.
As I said at the top of the programme, it's brown, blue and yellow with a saw-like spike sticking out of its rear. And the answer is...
It's not blue, Derek.
It's... What colour is it?
You said it's brown, blue and yellow.
Yeah.
Not blue.
What blue? What colour is it?
I don't know why you said blue. It's brown, black and yellow.
Right.
And it's called a sawfly.
Well, it's brown, black and yellow, as I said at the top of the programme, with a saw-like spike sticking out of its rear. And Aina says it is a...
Sawfly.
Sawfly. All right, guys, put your headphones on, if you would, please. Some of you will remember rolling your trousers up to the knee and turning stones over in our rivers in an attempt to catch slippery eels. Our streams and rivers enjoyed abundant stocks of these strange... snake-like fish. But sadly, not anymore. Numbers are down dramatically, I'm told, and not just here in Ireland. The European eel is on the critically endangered species list. Since the 1970s, numbers reaching Europe is thought to have declined by around 90%, possibly even 98%. Contributing factors include overfishing, parasites, barriers to migration, such as hydroelectric dams, and changes in the North Atlantic oscillation, Gulf Stream and North Atlantic drift. European eel eggs hatch in the depths of the Sargasso Sea in the Western Atlantic, and much of the European eel's life history was a mystery for centuries, as scientists couldn't find any discernible sex organs. Indeed, much of our eel's life cycle remains mysterious today. We're joined by Lucy Cook to enlighten us a little on how much we know and don't know. Lucy's a zoologist, TV presenter and author of The Unexpected Truth About Animals. Lucy, hello.
Hi there. Hi.
Lovely to speak with you. Tell us a little bit about your first encounter with eels.
I was obsessed with eels from a very young age, actually. My dad, when I was a small child, and I was an only child, basically. My half-sister's much older, so I kept to myself. And my father had sunk an old Victorian bath into the garden. I wanted to create the perfect pond ecosystem in. I was a very geeky child. And so my dad would drive me off to the marshes nearby, Romney Marsh, and I'd go fishing for whatever I could find to stock my pond. And the animals came two by two in my watery ark. I had sticklebacks and frogs and newts and whirligig beetles and all these wonderful creatures. But what eluded my net, or at least my hands actually, were eels, because I did manage to catch them. They were small, probably about the length and thickness of a pencil. They were elvers, young eels. But obviously every time, I don't know, have you ever tried to hold an eel?
Yeah, they certainly are very slippery, aren't they? They just slither off.
Oh, I mean, they are. I've been told by experts now that there is a way that you can actually hold onto an eel by pinching them behind their head and into their gills, which doesn't sound particularly friendly. But as a child, I didn't know how to do that. And I'd try and grab them and then they'd slither off into the grass, more like a snake than a fish out of water. So I became slightly obsessed with eels. It turns out I wasn't the first zoologist to become obsessed with eels, how they have tormented science since Aristotle.
They certainly have quite a life cycle, Lucy. There's no doubt about that. Just in terms of holding an eel, what I have found on working with eels in the past is, can you imagine this now? If you lift your middle finger, I should say, and then you trap the eel then gently but firmly inside that over the other two fingers, right and left of the middle finger. And that will actually hold your eel quite firmly.
If only I'd known you as a small child, you would have made my childhood so much happier.
Because it's so frustrating. Because they are so slimy,
yeah.
And every time you have one, you think you have him, and the next minute, he's gone again on you. But that was the only way I could find in the past where I could actually hold on to them.
Have they found the reproductive parts?
Well, certainly in the context of the reproduction, which Lucy has very, very clearly outlined, reproduction then happens down in the Sargasso Sea, as far as we know, because we find the juveniles, but we haven't got photographs of them actually mating down there. But certainly in terms of the female reproductive parts, I think, Lucy, they have found those. The males seem to mature at a later stage on their way back out. Have they actually found the testes on the male eels now at this stage?
Yes, they have. No, the sort of hunt for the reproductive organs of the eel went on from Aristotle was the first to try and find how eels' reproductive organs. And he thought, because he couldn't find them, he thought that eels actually reproduced by spontaneous generation. And he was a brilliant scientist, Aristotle. You know, he really sort of pioneered scientific thinking. And he'd sliced up millions of eels. And unlike any other fish that he opened up, He couldn't find their testicles and he couldn't find their ovaries. So he thought they emerged from the earth's guts. Those sort of coils of sand that you see by rivers were actually embryonic eels boiling out of the earth. And this idea that the eels must spontaneously generate was actually the main means of explaining how eels reproduce right up until the Middle Ages. It was the sort of 18th century. The Italians, who loved eel because it's a very fatty fish, because they have to, the eel has to fatten itself up enormously in order to swim 4,000 miles from the rivers of Europe to the Sargasso Sea. So that makes it really, really tasty. And so the Italians, they had a real sort of fascination with eel. And it became a sort of source of national pride to try and find the gonads of the eel, which were missing. And first of all, a chap called Mondini in 1777, he found the ovaries in the end. And they were disguised in the eel, in that they were these fatty fringes that looked nothing like ovaries in other creatures. So he was the one to find those. But the testicles were still missing. And there was a rather unlikely candidate who became involved in the search for the eel's testicles, and that's Sigmund Freud.
What was he doing looking for testicles on eels? I thought he was looking at people's brains and minds.
Afterwards, wasn't it?
I suppose that would drive anyone to something else. How did he get on anyway? Tell us, Lucy.
Well, I know, it's a rather extraordinary thought, isn't it, really, that Freud got involved in this with this sort of, like, phallocentric fish. Do you know what I mean? That he's there sort of trying to desperately find the testicles and the seat of the eel's desire. And this was long before he was searching for the seat of human desire. And he was just a student, and it was 1876, and he was a student in Vienna. And he was given the task. There was a Polish professor who claimed to have found the testicles of the eel, but he had taken no documentary evidence. So it fell to Freud to try and support this claim. And he spent an entire summer as a student. It was his first ever academic job, slicing up, I think it was 400 eels over the course of several weeks in search of their testicles. And he wrote in the book, I've got these fantastic drawings, doodles by a young Sigmund Freud that he did during his sort of vain search for the eel's testicles. Because he wrote to a friend many times, and these letters are still, you can access the letters. And he says, I've been tormenting myself with these eels. And then he drew these like fantastic doodles of eels with these very Mona Lisa smiles, enigmatic smiles on their faces. And then he got drawn lots of pictures of eels' eggs in pairs that, I mean, I don't know if you were a psychiatrist, they look remarkably like a pair of ladies' breasts, actually. But anyway, it's not for me to try and psychoanalyse Freud's young drawings. Yeah, so he was given the task of finding the testicles of the eel, and he totally failed. He couldn't find them. And so that was the end of his... He moved on to other pastures and found more success with humans than eels.
I think the problem is, as with all fish, the reproductive organs are very much a ribbon-type structure. When you say testicles, of course, immediately that evokes the idea that they're spherical and you're looking for actual testes, whereas in fact what you're looking for is ribbon-like structures. And they're very obvious and they develop before reproduction. But before that, it often takes, it takes really careful dissection to try and find out what they're about. But one thing that used to fascinate me when I was a student and learning first about eels, there was this huge controversy in the 70s about American eels and European eels, and whether or not they really were two different species. And you mention in the book this idea of counting the vertebrae, actually counting the backbone structures within the leptocephali, the little larvae, and within the adults. So if I remember right, and it's a long time ago, there was a difference in vertebrae count between the American eels and the European eels. And there was a fearsome row going on about whether or not it was to do with the distance from the Sargasso Sea. So one particular theory was that all of the eels all reproduced together, which seems reasonable enough. And some of the eel larvae were caught in currents that brought them back to the west, and other larvae were caught in currents that brought them back to the east. And if you were travelling east, it was far, far longer than it was to go west. So it was all to do with the developmental time as they went across the oceans. And that the eels that ended up then in North America, the vertebrae were a couple of vertebrae short in comparison to the ones that had done the really long journey to Europe. So have they solved that now? Is that now clear from genetics or something that there are clearly American eels and European eels?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, they are distinct species. Every eel expert that I've spoken to refers to them as distinct species. So I don't know how they ended up forming that opinion. But to my knowledge, I'm a zoologist and a writer. I'm not an eel expert.
Yeah.
They are different species.
I would imagine nowadays, I mean, that was a long time ago when we didn't have the genetic tools we have now. I would imagine with genetics, you could do that fairly readily. But it used to fascinate me because, I mean, at the time, these were seriously credible scientists that were fighting with one another about this thing about distance and doing all sorts of maths on it and so on. But it was extraordinary stuff.
The American eel is Anguilla rostrata. It's classified as a separate species.
Oh, they did that in the 70s as well.
But it's still up on the on the big book sort of thing now. And it's endangered, but not critically endangered as the European one is. But your thesis about them leaving the Sargasso Sea and depending on currents where they would end up, surely that doesn't work at all. Because if you have a whole lot of eels born in the Sargasso Sea from both sides of the Atlantic, the random nature of the current is going to throw some of them to America and others to Europe. So they're not going to be able to develop different numbers of vertebrae and so on and forth. That can't be the mechanism.
Well, I think at the end of the day, really what amazes me is the fact that if you do have this congregation of eels all spawning together, as far as we know, I think, and correct us if we're wrong, Lucy, this is not an active mechanism. This is a mechanism whereby it's drift that actually brings the larvae back. But the idea that you could then separate out rostrata from anguilla by means of the fact it's serendipity and, you know, that consistently they go into those currents, what it implies to me is that there are two spawning areas. It's a very big area, the Sargasso, but it implies to me that there's probably two distinct zones because we need, you know, the same numbers or at least the same proportion of eels coming back all the time to maintain those two very different species. And this is all part and parcel of the argument that was going on in the 70s. This is exactly what they were talking about. I think they're fascinating creatures because of that. You know?
But they have, the numbers have collapsed completely. I remember my husband who lived in Clonmel in County Tipperary and the eels were all over the place and they wouldn't eat the eels because they reckoned the eels ate rats. And if you ate the eels, it was the equivalent of eating rats and you couldn't possibly do this. And these eels lived beside a factory that slaughtered animals and put the blood into the river, and the eels got very big and strong and fat from doing this. But nowadays, of course, naturally, we don't want slaughtered houses putting blood into rivers feeding eels. But it's more than just that. It's more than just cleaning up this kind of pollution. I mean, the whole eel population in Europe has collapsed. And is it because they don't come anymore? Are we managing to get as many as we did and banjax them here? Or are they not coming in the first instance?
And I remind you of the Battle of Jutland. It was said after the Battle of Jutland, the fishermen up there caught eels in huge numbers and fatter and bigger than any eels they had caught previously. And it was inferred that these eels ate the bodies of the sailors killed in this terrible battle.
I've been told by an eel sniggler in the UK that the best way to catch eel is to throw a dead cat into the water. Because they do love to feast on decomposing flesh.
The other way of catching eels is to use ladies' tights.
Excuse
so what
me.
You do is...
How did you find this out, Ken?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that story, but interestingly, it does work and it works very well. So what you do is you get from a very understanding lady, you get a pair of tights and you put some fish inside the tights and you make a small tubular little sausage shape and cast it out on your fishing line. And when the eel takes that into his or her mouth, there's all these little vomerine teeth up at the top, up at the roof of the mouth, and you can actually take the eel in without having to put a hook in it at all. And that's the way the Maoris fish for eels, not with tights, but with natural materials that they had available to them on the South Island. They developed this technique of actually catching eels. But like most predatory fish, they're very opportunistic. And if they get a source of food, they're going to go in and make hay out of it. But certainly in mountain streams and so on, they predominantly will feed on small fish and they'll feed on snails and so on. So they're very clean living. That's why I think you get the lovely taste off the flesh that that Lucy was mentioning. And Lucy, in terms of the status of the eels now, because there's been this big recovery plan now, goodness, it must be 10 or 12 years, maybe more, since it was put in place by the EU. Are we seeing some sort of slow recovery in terms of eel populations?
I have to say, I'm not the person to ask that question to, I'm afraid. I don't know the answer to that. I know that the reason for their decline is overfishing. It's largely to feed the Japanese market, although all of Asia eats a lot of eels. And I know that in America, eels are trapped in vast numbers and sent over to Asia. The Japanese species of eel, they have actually managed to breed that in captivity. And literally just in, it's just cost, you know, hundreds of thousands in order to make that happen. So it's a very prohibitive way of making sushi. So the only way to feed the hungry mouths that want to eat them is by catching elvers from the rivers of America and Europe and then sending them to China where they're put in farms and then fattened up.
The other thing that I find extraordinary about eels, the big you mentioned in the book, the fact that they separate out into the males and the females. Very often the males are in the lower reaches and so on. But some of these females in poor areas poor in the sense of not a lot of food, they can live for extraordinary length of time. In the research station I used to run in the west of Ireland, I remember my colleague getting an eel, and you have to take out the little otoliths, the ear stones, and look for the rings inside and try and count them. And we ran out of rings at 46. But this eel was definitely 46 plus, and it was only about 6 pounds weight. These are extraordinarily long-lived, delicate creatures.
So the secret to longevity.
There was one that lived in Sweden to the age of 88.
88.
My goodness.
No, the figure is actually 155 years in a place called Brattvik.
That's disputed, though, I think.
Well, it's not so much disputed. There was a practice in Sweden, if you had a well, of capturing an eel and putting it into the well, because that would clean up all the little parasites that might contaminate the water. Now, this eel was in a well and was taken out of the well every so often and shown on Swedish television. But the test really is of how long it could live. Now, it could live 155 years before. And there's another one now catching up on it, I believe. However,
why would it die?
We have to get back to the Sargasso Sea and have a Liebestod, a great Wagnerian love orgy, and then heel over and say, well, I've done it, I can go.
Well, anyway, Lucy.
You see why Freud was interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lucy, thank you very much indeed. It was a fascinating conversation about eels. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Ken, just before we go, you want to talk to us about the water resources management training project you're undertaking.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Derek. There's a very good new body in Ireland now, about 5 or 6 years, called Waters and Communities. And it's a great pity that this particular organisation wasn't in place before we had the debacle over and the row over water in the past. Because what they're trying to do is they're trying to get communities all over the country to actually take cognizance of the water resources in their areas and to put together projects that will do two things. That will raise awareness amongst the various communities in terms of the water resources and the actual treasures that they have. And secondly, projects that can actually help to try and improve water resources in their area. So there's a leader company, a leader partnership company in County Louth. And they asked myself and my colleague Martin McGarrigle to run the first, I think, of a training programme. And basically what we did was we advertised to throughout County Louth in August, September time. And we said, if you are your community group, if you're interested in coming and learning about fresh water, about estuaries and about nearshore, and you're interested in seeing how you as a community might be able to influence people's awareness about the scarcity of water, about what we need to do to try and make sure water is clean and so on, do come along. And we've been running that now since October, and we've had the most fantastic response. And what I find really interesting is the mixture in terms of communities that we're actually getting there. So we have some really, really seriously interested farmers. We have some sheep farmers. We also have a lot of tidy townspeople. We have angling clubs. So we've a great variety of people. And we're just at the end of the training now, and we have now assembled with their help a whole list of different projects that they're hoping now might be funded to try and raise awareness, as I say, in these areas. And when you look at some of the rivers in County Louth, rivers like the River Dee and the River Glyde and so on, where they're flowing out, they look as if they're just a river. When you go back up into the hinterland, they have the most fantastic series of lochs and wetlands and so on, all of which people need to be aware of and need to understand how to manage these and how to deal with all of the issues that are coming from climate change in an environmental context. So it's working very well.
Now talk to me about the Freshwater Detective series.
So hopefully now part of the follow through will be that since, I think maybe 2010 now, I've been developing a series of training programs for communities called my Freshwater Detective series. So I have 1 day courses and then I do other courses as well where you get a certificate and it teaches people how to actually go and walk a river or walk a stream and classify it and see how well it's doing, pick up if there are problems and be able to designate it then as a pristine environment. Because what we're missing is the fact that under a big EU piece of legislation called the Water Framework Directive, the way our water resources are managed at the moment, and all over Europe it's the same situation, there's a limit in terms of the amount of water courses you can actually walk or sample. So each of the top layers of a river, they're actually known as first, second and third order streams. So if you have a tiny little stream coming down, that's a first order stream. If it meets another tiny stream, then the two joined together becomes a second order and so on. So it's usually third and fourth order streams where they meet is the very top sampling point that, say, the EPA or whatever will look at. And they have no real knowledge about the little baby streams in the mountains that are so important in terms of insects and in terms of plants. They are the arteries, if you like, of the bigger rivers. And what we're doing now through the Freshwater Detective series, and we have some great groups now out on Loch Corrib and down on the Meg that have been trained, and they're going and they're looking at all these tiny arteries and building this fantastic database of information. And they're finding all sorts of beautiful, pristine environments that the local authorities now are now aware of, and they need to actually preserve these, and they know that.
Well, more details can be found of all of the items covered on today's programme, but particularly what Ken has been speaking about just there, rte.ie/Mooney. My thanks to Ken Whelan, to Annie Lennon, to Richard Collins. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. On sound we had Sheila Neveuil, and the series producer is Anna Leddy. Until next week, goodbye.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. I know a man, he came from my hometown. He wore his passion for his woman like a thorny crown. He said, Dolores, I live in fear. My love for you is so overpowering, I'm afraid that I will disappear. Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. And I know a woman became a wife. These are the very words she uses to describe her life. She said a good day ain't got no rain. She said a bad day's when I lie in bed and think of things that might have been. Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. The nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. And I know a father who had a son. He longed to tell him all the reasons for the things he'd done. He came a long way just to explain. Kissed his boy as he lay sleeping, then he turned around and headed home again. He slip sliding, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.